Why don't we as libertarians say, Trump was right about that. There are too many people in jail. There are too many, in particular, black and brown people in jail who are hit with this disproportionately for nonviolent crimes that we as libertarians don't think should have been crimes in the first place. What people on the right, what Republicans are talking to those people, particularly at a time when more black Americans voted for Trump in the last election and more Hispanics significantly did too. We should be capitalizing on this, and there are a few leaders that have, but I think we could do much more.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the show. With me today is my good friend, Jack Hunter. He is a conservative journalist and co-author of the book with Senator Rand Paul, The Tea Party Goes to Washington. Jack, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Great to be with you, Brad. Been looking forward to it.
Yeah, I know. I've talked to you about this podcast for a long time, and I've always had you in the back of my mind as somebody I had to have on the show. We're friends outside of work, but also we're very much on the same page on most political and policy issues. But the reason I decided to have you on this week is because of your recent long-form essay that you published in The American Conservative about how libertarian thought and free market policy can adapt and respond to the populist moment we're in to actually create a winning coalition for the GOP. It was a really fascinating essay. The link to it is going to be in the description for people to read after they finish this episode. But I think I just want to lay the groundwork for it. What is populism?
Well, we should probably start there. I think a lot of our libertarian friends think that populism itself and liberty or free markets, libertarian populism, that libertarianism and populism are mutually exclusive. Populism is not an ideology. You know, I say in my piece that the most libertarian populist movement we've had in recent times was certainly the Tea Party about a decade ago. I mean, that was against government spending and the national debt. And that was indeed a populist movement. Nancy Pelosi tried to call it AstroTurf at the time, like it was made up or the Koch brothers had invented it or whatnot. But, you know, I always go back to like Howard Dean in 2004. That was a populist movement. What Bernie Sanders is doing in the Democratic Party today, his two presidential campaigns were populist movements. What Jesse Jackson did back in 1988 wasn't exactly what Donald Trump did in our own time, but it was a populist movement. It's called that as such. It was at the time and is still today remembered as such. There are all kinds of the counterculture in the 60s was populist. I mean, we could go on and on and on with this. Right now, you know, a lot of people on the right, particularly libertarians, think populism is strictly, you know, anti-immigrant, anti-immigration, protectionist, you know, anti-free trade. That is a type of populism, and it is a type of populism you see throughout the globe in many places. But the idea that that's the only type of populism that can exist, I think, not only is unproductive in a bad way to think about it, it's just simply not true.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a mistake to think. Just look at how many people went from supporting Bernie Sanders in 2016 in the primary, then switching to Trump.
Right.
A lot of populist voters are not deep-seated policy analysts with firm views on tariff rates and immigration levels. What they are is somebody that feels like the establishment has let them down. Like
right.
The concentrated powers in our society, big tech, big government, big business, are being used to perpetuate the interests of an established and elite class, not to help them. That's how they feel. I feel like populism
right.
is more of a sentiment than an ideology.
Populism, if you had to give it a proper definition, is the little guy fighting back against the big guy. Now, who the big guy is and who the little guy is or how they feel or what the framework of that is what we're actually talking about. In this moment, Donald Trump has successfully been able to take Americans who feel disenfranchised or cast out or just like, you know, the elites are working against them and speak directly to them. That's why he could say often terrible things or borderline racist things or things that probably just shouldn't be said. They didn't care about all that because they felt like this was the one guy that was telling them the truth. 75 million people voted for Donald Trump. So I'm saying in a moment where, you know, right-leaning libertarians like ourselves are seeing people like Josh Hawley sort of claim the populist Trump nationalist label and is pushing that and wants the levers of government to do things allegedly or ostensibly for right-wing purposes and to make government bigger and more powerful. And people like Tom Cotton are doing the same thing with Trump populism as we speak. He came out with a piece at CNN today talking about how America needs to put more people in jail. We have an under-incarceration problem. I'm saying yeah, Trump talked about law and order and Cotton wants to take it further, but, you know, maybe we should take that Trump legacy and go further in the other direction with the First Step Act and the fact that too many people are in jail for mandatory minimums, which is also part of what Trump did. Alice Johnson is free today because of Donald Trump, and she'll be the first to tell you that. Why don't we, and I know I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but all of this is connected. Why don't we as libertarians say, Trump was right about that. There are too many people in jail. There are too many, in particular, black and brown people in jail who are hit with this disproportionately for nonviolent crimes that we as libertarians don't think should have been crimes in the first place. What people on the right, what Republicans are talking to those people, particularly at a time when more black Americans voted for Trump in the last election and more Hispanics significantly did too. We should be capitalizing on this. And there are a few leaders that have, but I think we could do much more.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the problems is that some libertarians, especially Washington, D.C. libertarians, they'll just say, oh, populism, I wish it would just go away. And they get drawn into this caricature of defending big corporations and kind of looking the other way on some of the worst elements of big government because they don't want to pick those battles or be associated with the wrong right-wing movements. And I think that's the problem, because right now, the only populist messages out there, or at least the loudest ones, are big government populist messages. You have, right. You have the so-called democratic socialists on the left. You have the national conservatives and nationalists on the right who want to use big government for the people. But I actually think you can make a strong and comprehensive case for limited government and free markets in a populist way. The government is so often the one that's screwing over the little guy, don't you think?
And I think you can do that in the way that Tim Carney argued back around 2013, post the 2012 election, when Mitt Romney lost and was seen as an elite. And Tim Carney of the Washington Examiner, who I borrow from in my piece, I build upon what he was saying back then. I think he was right then, he's right today. And you're right, Brad. I mean, coming out of these COVID lockdowns, I think there's a lot to talk about how government has destroyed businesses and people's jobs. I mean, in an immediate sense, forget about the cronyism. And, you know, I began my piece within January, the whole Reddit situation with GameStop and them sort of rigging the system. So there's so many examples of the big guy. Once again, this is populism, having a target on the little guy and the little guy feeling that way. Most importantly, we need to speak to that. As far as people, some of our friends not liking being populist, I think a lot of that is, you know, putting fashion instead of function. We should care about function and being effective and talking to people where they're at. I have never understood pre-Trump, you know, going all the way back to Ron Paul in 2008, when I became a libertarian, how we as libertarians are going to get any of the things we want. Think about what we want. We want to end the American empire. We want to bring the troops home. So you got to take on the Pentagon and that structure, right? Is some person at the Pentagon going to help us with this? Or is it going to be a populist uprising? We want to end the drug war, and it's going in that direction, thankfully. But was it public pressure from the bottom? Or was somebody, there's Kamala Harris and Jeff Sessions working together to make this happen? No. You see what I'm saying? It's going to have to be grassroots up, making politicians do things they wouldn't have done otherwise. And that's how do you do that without populism? I don't get it.
Yeah, and you have to convince people that the issues that actually are hurting them can be traced back to big government. Because right now, they unfortunately don't see the ways that the problems are caused by big government, and they think that's the solution. But in reality, so many of the ways, look at the way that lockdowns crushed businesses, and yet at the same time, the stock market and big corporations are thriving. Look at the way that Amazon is aggressively lobbying for a $15 minimum wage because it knows it will bankrupt its small business competitors and leave them with even more of a monopoly than they're already amassing. Look at the way that many big tech companies are actually lobbying the federal government for more regulations because they know that that will lock out competitors who might displace these really woke and toxic semi-monopolies. So I guess to focus on economics in terms of the populism, so-called populist economics, oftentimes from the right, sounds like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren with some of the things they want big government to do. But I think you can make an economic message that's populist, that's all about limiting government and opening up markets.
I think that's right. In my brief exchange with Tim Carney for this piece, I just wanted his idea and where his mind was about libertarian populism, you know, 7 or 8 years later, and big tech in particular. He was like, don't give them the regulations they want and the subsidies. And those are things that people don't even think about. Before we get to more government action that could be used by Democrats down the road or right now, why don't we talk about things like that? I think you're absolutely right. I don't think the average American understands the degree, and maybe business people do a little bit more just than somebody who's an employee, how much big business works in tandem with government to squeeze out the little guy. We as libertarians or conservatives or just free marketeers, however you want to look at it, should be talking about this more. You know, one of the things I like that Rand Paul did in 2016 when he ran for president, that didn't go very far, but he was going into black barbershops and talking about the weave regulations. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do.
They have these high fines or whatever the hell they have to pay to the government. It's extortion, basically. But, you know, you're a woman who knows how to braid hair, then learned it from her mother, who learned it from her mother. You have to get some sort of exorbitant license that costs too much and a gazillion hours of schooling that other trades don't have to do for some arbitrary reason. Go and talk to them and be like, hey, I'm a Republican. I'm for small government. I'm going to get rid of that. Or I'm going to work with your local officials to help get rid of that. We're going to talk about it. That might work. I think there's a myriad of ways that we could talk to people in ways that maybe a handful of libertarians have that Republicans don't. That more can be shown the way, more can lead that way. We just have to sort of set the agenda, I guess, which is what my piece is about.
Yeah, and one of the things you mentioned in your essay that I want to break down a little bit is the fact that, and this is quite a narrative-busting fact, right? But President Trump actually improved significantly on the Hispanic and black vote, particularly with black men. And that's despite his history of saying very questionable things about race that all of us, I think, or many of us would say shouldn't have said that and really not great. But just the sheer fact that the left has become so identitarian, so toxic, so woke, and increasingly socialist in the mainstream of the Democratic Party, that combined with the pre-pandemic results of the economy under Trump, saw him, I think, achieve significant gains with minority voters. Some people respond to that, some populist people, and say, well, then the GOP needs to be a working class party. And then they say, so to do that, let's embrace more big government, labor subsidies, or conservative senators have introduced proposals to increase the federal minimum wage. But I think that's the totally opposite direction. But then I guess the question is, how do you sell that free market, limited government message to a very important block and growing of minority voters who might consider Republicans?
Absolutely. It was probably been about a month now that, and I can never remember his name, I think it's Droser, but he was a progressive pollster, really got into the weeds on this, and I included some in my piece at the American Conservative on this subject. And he was trying to figure out why Donald Trump received more of the black vote in 2020 than it did in 2016, and such a significant jump with Hispanic Americans. So the one crossover issue for both groups was the far left, the woke left, defund the police, and all of these slogans. It turns out that black Americans do want to talk about police brutality and their unique and often worse experience than people who look like you or I, Brad. They want to talk about that, but they also want to call the police if something bad is happening. So that didn't register, you know, they want to be safe in their neighborhoods, a lot of which are not safe, and they have their problems with the police. That doesn't mean they don't need the police. I think there's an area for libertarians uniquely to talk about this in ways that a Tom Cotton nationalist could not and would not and doesn't want to, and people on the left who are sort of attached to the Antifa woke mobs or whatever don't want to because that's their left flank and they don't feel politically like they can do that. I quoted Jonathan Capehart, an African-American journalist at the Washington Post, in my piece, and he's quoting some Antifa kid who got picked up in Seattle or something, and the kid's saying something like, my black and brown brothers and sisters, I will fight with you. And he said, no thanks, basically. And I think there are a lot of Americans of color who feel that way. Now, that combined, let me say this last point. That pollster basically said that if in any election, most of them or a lot of them would have voted for Joe Biden, but the increased amounts came out later. They almost all went for Trump. And it was precisely things like this, that in any other scenario, they would have voted for Biden. But in this case, they were voting the way a white conservative would vote, or many white conservatives voted. That's significant. And we need to play on that. He also noted that things, especially with the Hispanic community, thrift, industry, hard work, what we think of as the American dream, that is runs deep with both groups, but particularly Hispanics, newcomers, whether they're here legally or illegally, that registered with them, and they saw that in Trump more than what the Democrats were preaching. This is just old-fashioned Republican conservative values, right? So you double down on that stuff. We're not as far apart as we think culturally. And a lot of these things, you know, I say in the piece, if we pitch to people who are outside of our circles, and we're talking about minorities right now, the big government harms you in all sorts of ways that even white Republicans might not be thinking of, but should, you could make even more inroads. I think that the pollster also found that especially young black men want somebody who's defiant, who's anti-establishment, who's populist. And that was a determining factor. You take out the BET president also said that Black Entertainment Television expressed a similar sentiment. If you could tie all this together, we've got a lot to work with. At the same time, Tom Cotton and nationalists are saying we need to throw more people in jail, not talk about the First Step Act. And in fact, the First Step Act was bad. And then they make up the lie about George Floyd dying of fentanyl instead of getting his neck crushed, which we learned in court this week. That is what happened. But you see what I'm saying. Those are the forces in play.
Yeah, I do, for sure. And I think there was such an opening in 2020 on criminal justice for somebody willing to say something sensible that you can say, if you could say two things at once, there was a huge market here. One, police brutality is a real problem and it's bad and horrible and what happened to George Floyd is. And here are some reforms like qualified immunity and like no-knock warrants that we're going to do to limit the deadly power that police have sometimes abused. But at the same time, we're not going to defund the police. All cops are not bastards. And we're not going to downplay or look the other way about rioting and looting. It seemed to me that on the left, everybody said the things about the police, but they took it too far. And then they wouldn't condemn rioting and looting, or they'd condemn it very quietly and then not mention it again. And that was really devastating. Widespread rioting and looting. People were killed. Businesses right. were ruined. But then on the right, people were like, nothing to see here, folks. We're not going to support any reforms. Oh, George Floyd, that was bad. But bad apples, good system. So it just seemed to me like nobody gets it. And if somebody could, there must be huge demand for that sensible message, just not among this crop of politicians.
You're right. And it only takes a few leaders to sort of put that out there. One of the most heroic things, and I include this in my piece, that Tim Scott did in the midst of this conversation about police reform and police brutality is introduce a police reform bill that enough Republicans did not get behind. But, you know, the libertarians, Rand Paul and people like that were certainly talking about it. The president supported it, which is the biggest deal of all.
Democrats filibustered it, though.
Well, that's what I was getting at. So politics plays a role in all of this, and Democrats and the left can wag their finger all they want. But there was a lot of good stuff in that Tim Scott bill. It's never enough. The First Step Act needs to be a second, third, fourth step act. I think many of us would agree with that. But it was more than you were going to get elsewise. And it was the first time Republicans had put a big foot forward on that issue. And Democrats cared more about not giving ours a win than that reform. They're full of it. So they're hard to take seriously. I honestly think this reform needs Republican cooperation or even inspiration that we need to put it forward first to get any of this done. I think Grover Norquist used to say when he was doing Right on Crime and talking about prison reform back then, he's like, the left doesn't have any credibility on these issues. That might be worse now after this last summer. It has to be the right, the party of law and order, to say, hey, here's some problems. Let's get it done.
Yeah. And so I want to pick up on that in just a minute. But first, I want to introduce you guys to a message from one of our partners over at the We Are Libertarians podcast network.
Our goal at the Chris Spangle Show is to help you sound smarter while talking with your friends. If you struggle to understand politics, we explain it from an independent libertarian perspective with all of the irreverence modern politics deserves. We toss out the screaming heads and put people before political parties and give context to the news to make you think. I'm the host. I'm a 15-year veteran of politics and media, and this show is published every Saturday. It's part of the We Are Libertarians Network, and be sure to join Wall Plus for bonus podcasts, the complete archives, commercial-free shows, and more. Subscribe now at WeAreLibertarians.com.
So, Jack, we were just talking about this, and I want to pivot slightly and go with the question of COVID-19 and 2020 and the last year. It seems to me that the people who think the future of the right is populist in a big government sense must have not been paying very good attention over the last year, right? Because the coronavirus was a series of government failures, the CDC and FDA blocking testing. They failed to shut down the border in time. They blocked private companies from tests. They ordered in some states that nursing homes accept COVID positive patients. They've done these harsh lockdowns with no basis in science and random and arbitrary. And now we're talking about COVID passports and tracking people. And so I just don't understand how anyone can look at the last year and come away with the message that what we need is more government.
Well, we'll let those suggesting new government powers, we'll see how that pans out. But in the meantime, you're absolutely right, Brad. You know, people were talking about a libertarian moment in 2015. This might be the libertarian moment right now. You have things wide open in Texas with cases lower than ever. And then some of these lockdown states like Michigan and other places under heavy lockdown are having more cases go up than ever. So I think when you see a state that people like Joe Rogan move from California to, like Texas, because he wants to be more free, and you see people there now living pretty normally. The vaccine rollouts have gone wonderfully. And that's how you can live, and you can have open your business and keep your job versus how blue states have done it, or some of these Republicans who want to behave like blue state governors and politicians and members of Congress and offer new government solutions. Hello, Josh Hawley. We'll see what looks more attractive to more people. And look, I've told our libertarian friends this for years, and you get the question, how can we make more people libertarian? I say, you're asking the wrong question. How can you make people like things that we like, no matter what they call themselves? I don't care if they call themselves progressive or Republican or Democrat or conservative or alien or whatever they want to call themselves. That's the trick. And I think there's a lot of opportunities during these COVID times, post-COVID, hopefully soon.
Yeah, but the one front where things have become enormously unlibertarian in the last year is the economy, whether it was government regulations making people's livelihoods illegal, shutting down their businesses, multi-trillion dollar spending bonanzas full of fraud and partisan incompetence and unrelated goodies and politician pet projects. I guess, though, I think with my perspective on economics and my analysis, right, there's going to be real costs and problems that emerge from all of this. But the question is, will people see? Will they connect the dots? And I guess that depends in part on the work that people like you and I and people bigger than us do. But isn't there an opening here with this runaway spending, this total big government corporatist approach that they're taking under the Biden administration and everything they did under COVID for a Tea Party 2.0 in terms of fiscal restraint and free markets coming back to the forefront?
I absolutely think there is, and it has to be organic. What you're saying, that you people like you and I and our friends who write need to connect the dots, that's our job. That's what they do. You should see this in this way. Here's how we can get where you want to be and away from the horrible place you've been. The reaction to this administration and many of the things they have done already and many of the things they are going to do, I think there are a lot of Americans that say, like, hey, you people on the right have been talking about this debt thing for a long time, but it doesn't really happen. How much more can they spend, Brad, before it actually does happen? Or something like Bitcoin becomes more of an alternative currency than just something 10% of the population is invested in at the moment. You see what I'm getting at? And that's unforeseen. That's the kind of thing, just like this pandemic, that like nobody could have ever saw coming. But I think there could be some not only opportunities, but lessons learned. A lot of what Ron DeSantis is doing down in Florida, he's not a, you know, down the checkbox line libertarian by any stretch of the imagination. But having the attitude like he did on 60 Minutes saying, or that was the segment that railroaded him, but in recent interviews saying, the CDC said don't vaccinate seniors first. Guess what we did? You know, doing the opposite of what the authorities say and what the Biden administration was saying. People see that, they're like, yeah, that looks good to me. And he's doing it in the name of free markets and keeping businesses open. And I think that's a good example.
Yeah, there is. And DeSantis has done, especially in keeping Florida open and defying a lot of the narratives and really achieving good results, despite them having the oldest population in the country outside of Maine, is impressive, though. But even in people like DeSantis, there's this strain of big government. He has, I think, proposed proposals that would punish tech companies that don't host the speech that he likes with government penalties. His order against vaccine passports, which is kind of a tricky issue, but his order actually extends not just to the government won't do this, which is what I support, but private businesses can't. Your small shop, you know, or restaurant cannot require proof of vaccination. So I guess with someone like him and those issues, can they really be fully considered on board in terms of limited government and free markets?
Well, yes and no. On the examples I cited, and I don't think there's anything wrong with picking your battles, yes. He's a popular figure within the Republican Party. He's done a lot of things that we like. Now let's talk about the things we don't like, which you just brought up. We don't believe that you should be able to tell private businesses how to operate like that. How many of those private businesses don't like being told that they have to? I'm sure there are many businesses, people with different politics or just beliefs, who want a different set of rules, you know, and they should be allowed to do that. How do you get DeSantis to not do things like that? I know the governor of Missouri said no to vaccine passports, but didn't order businesses to do anything. So you could see examples in other places, for one. Brad, I think a lot of this for leaders, governors like DeSantis, certainly for President Trump when he was still there, and I'm sure Joe Biden, who has lots of people around him running things and isn't clear himself about what's going on around him or in his orbit, I think it's the right people influencing them. I think if Ron DeSantis is talking a lot more to Josh Hawley than Rand Paul, he's going to start to govern a lot more like Josh Hawley than what Rand Paul might want. I'm still convinced to this day that we might have boots on the ground in Iran, and we certainly would have bombed Iran if not for the influence of Senator Paul on Trump and the influence of Tucker Carlson on Trump. I believe both of those things, and I've talked to many people who also believe them. So who's around a popular leader's circle, has influence, is going to have a lot to do with it, and that's why it's important for libertarians to make our arguments in populist ways, which is where all the energy is right now. And he's certainly a populist governor, I would argue.
Yeah, and so to put our political prediction hat on, if we look at the upcoming midterms in 2022, and we look at even at the 2024 Republican presidential primary, who could you see, or what kind of a campaign could you see in terms of politicians coming on this liberty Republican, libertarian populist message and really resonating with the base and getting somewhere?
Well, that's why I've been keeping an eye on DeSantis. Obviously, 3.5-4 years is a long time. Anything can happen. I remember when Sarah Palin was a front runner at one time for that happens. Rand Paul was a front runner. So we didn't think that, or he didn't necessarily think that, but people were saying he was that based on the political situation in 2013, 2014. He was on the cover of Time. As far as what we have to look forward to in 2022 and 2024, I think the Republicans are going to do well. As far as a figure for president, that's not clear. If Rand Paul ran again, I don't know that he wants to. He hasn't said that. Do you see him on some list? That's one option. Will DeSantis be as popular by then, or some crazy scandal we don't know about happened? It seems to happen with too many people these days that we like. I do look at, and I've told you for a long time, that I think so much of what people believe has to be encapsulated by a leader, a figure. So if there's not one clear person, another Ron Paul or somebody like that, or including his son, and there might be, I think the addition of Nancy Mace to Congress, who's had a fairly high profile for a freshman member so far, is wonderful. Here's this relatively young liberty Republican that not only a lot of libertarians and Republicans already like, but a lot of our female libertarian friends have for the first time at that level. And I really like that. I'm talking about in Congress. You've got Thomas Massey, he's always there and I think has a lot of political talent. Peter Meyer, who knew that the successor for Justin Amash was going to be pretty libertarian on a lot of things. You had him on a show. I think that's one of the best interviews I've heard with the congressman. So there are a number of figures out there like that. Does DeSantis become more libertarian over time as he reacts to the Biden administration and talks to the right people? Does he become more like Josh Hawley? I think a lot of the stuff that Josh Hawley and that camp want to do is pretty optimistic and is going to look a lot like some of the stuff Biden wants to do, which is going to be easy to talk a lot of Republicans out of. It's like, do you want Biden-like? Do you want Democrat-like or light? So, I mean, look at that $10 minimum wage proposal from Mitt Romney and... Was that Rubio or was that, well, that was Hawley, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was, Romney. It was Cotton.
You didn't see Republicans or talk radio or Fox News or right-wing podcasts like, oh my God, this is great. We absolutely have to do this. It kind of got a mixed reaction, right? So yeah. How many times are we going to see that? The big test right now is big tech and what we do. And it's problematic for libertarians because the censorship is a problem. But at the same time, you know, do we want to hand those new powers over to people we don't agree with, which is what would happen right now because Republicans aren't in the majority. So it's a difficult.
We could do a whole podcast on big tech because I've grown increasingly troubled by the situation, but I don't like the kind of populist proposal, like revoke 230 or section 230 and that kind of thing. We'll have to have another conversation about that soon, because we got to do something. I just don't know what it is yet. There's very clearly a problem with the tech sector and with social media censorship, and kind of corporate shill libertarians who pretend otherwise aren't actually doing liberty any favors, in my view. But
sure.
just to kind of end on a high note, I will say this. I didn't want Biden to win, to be elected president, but I knew, and it has proven true, that if he was, all of a sudden there would be much more demand for my services in terms of free market economic commentary. And all of a sudden, since he's been elected, I've been on Fox and Friends and Fox Business, and I've had big op-eds land. And it's just like the truth of it is, I wish they cared all the time. But when there is a Democratic president, conservative media, conservative consumers, Republican politicians, they tend to become more fiscally conservative and more concerned with free market values and all that. So I guess at least in the short term on that front, things are looking up. Jack, now for the most important part of the show. I know that you listen to the show and you've heard all the crazy food takes, so I'm curious for what you have stored up for us. What is your most controversial food opinion?
Well, I can't ignore anybody who knows me. And Brad, we've known each other for a while. I don't know if you even know this, but people know me for a long time. No, this isn't a food I like, but it's a food I absolutely detest. Onions. Now, that's not unusual. A lot of people don't like onions, but let me explain to you the degree to which I don't like onions. And there is such a thing as negligible onions, like in tomato sauce. You don't know they're there. You don't really taste onion. You can't crunch into them. That's the big one with me. A number of years ago, you know, the crappy little McDonald's single cheeseburgers?
Mm-hmm.
Anytime I get them, which is infrequently, no onions, right? Because those come, those gross little diced things they put on them. There was one left on it. I didn't eat those burgers again for about 3 years. Because I associated McDonald's cheeseburgers plain with, that's going to taste like an onion. I would literally rather bend over and bite the ground and whatever dirt is there than eat a significant sized onion. So I hate them that much. If there needs to be a federal law, Josh Hawley and I are going to work on this. Federal ban on onions. We'll get that done.
that is an interesting one and quite an impassioned food take. So Jack, my friend, thanks so much for coming on the show. Everybody, you can read his piece. Check out his social medias in the episode description below.
Thanks, Brad.